Okay, so this is Bio 231. It's September 23rd, and we're going to talk about appendicular skeleton today. That's the job. Sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign that sign-in sheet, that your receipt that you are in class. Let's take a look at the schedule. What's happening here? Sounds good. All right, so the 23rd, indeed, we're going to do appendicular skeleton, but we also have practicums today for the Wednesday labs, practicum number one. And the next week, we just have lectures. Your next lecture exam is October 12th, and here are the chapters involved with that. You also notice, what day of the week is exam two on? It is on a Monday. And that is noteworthy because there's something else happening on that Monday. There is lab practicum number two. So the Monday labs get a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day. Some get the practicum before the lecture. Some get the practicum after the lecture exam. So it all depends if you have morning or afternoon lab. So just prepare for that. I think it's not too terribly bad because the information on the practicum corresponds fairly well with the information that you have to know for the lecture exam. So they should reinforce each other. So in a sense, you can kill two birds with one stone, more or less. All right, so that's the Monday lab. Right, get a practicum and lecture exam on the same day. And I just want to keep pointing out that the Wednesday labs will experience the same thing, and that will be on December 9th. That's the very last day of school. That's a Wednesday. So that just means that lecture exam number four and lab practicum number four will occur on the same day. Right, but the Monday group will get it on Monday, not on Wednesday. So you can kind of switch places there. Does anybody have a question on the schedule? No questions? Questions so far, so good. Do you have any more deadlines this week? I got a question for you. If you don't have one for me, I got a question for you. Any deadlines for anything this week? Quiz. Oh, when is that? Thursday. Online quiz. At what time do you have to be completed by? 11 p.m. Hopefully you are all 1 week ahead of schedule so that if you miss a deadline, it doesn't matter because it's already completed. And if there's a problem with Blackboard, if I didn't program it properly, just send me an email and I can fix it real quick. Okay, so that's the online. All right, so let's look at the slide on the right. I see a skeleton, and I hope you recall that if we look at all of the bones in the skeleton, they can be broken down into two main regions. Right? First region is in this nice gray color, skull, vertebral column, ribs, sternum. What part of the skeleton is that? I like that. Axial skeleton, and that's what we're working in lab with. This is the last week for the axial skeleton. And then the second group of bones is the... Who can tell me what these upper and lower appendages, what skeleton do they make up? The appendicular skeleton, right? So we take all the bones, they can either be part of the axial skeleton or the appendicular skeleton. One thing that might be a little bit strange to visualize, the sacrum right here, since it's really an integral part of the pelvis, it nonetheless is still part of the vertebral column or axial skeleton. But the hip bones themselves are part of the appendicular skeleton. That might be the only thing that's a little bit confusing there. All right, so we're going to start looking at appendicular skeleton. Unless somebody's got a question about that particular slide, I think we're probably pretty good. Oh, I did have to make another comment. All right, so appendicular skeleton are bones of the appendages. Like here we have an arm and a forearm and a hand and a wrist and all that kind of stuff. All right, so bones that make up an appendage plus some bones that attach that appendage to the axial skeleton. So that might be a good thing to visualize. All right, the bones that attach an appendage to the axial skeleton are called girdles because they surround your body. And the two bones that help attach your upper appendage to the axial skeleton are the clavicle and scapula, two bones. They're part of the appendicular skeleton, but they're special because they attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. And for the lower appendage, the bone that attaches is the ascoxae, or pelvic bone. Azkakse is two words, and you'll become familiar with that. So the upper appendage attached to the axial skeleton via the pectoral girdle up here, and down over here, the Azkakse make up the pelvic girdle. So the axial skeleton has bones of the appendages plus the girdles. That's another way to think about those things that attach your appendages to your axial skeleton. Okay, anybody got a question on that? I can barely see clavicle and scapula, but we're going to look at detail right now. You're pretty good with that? All right. So let's look right here. So this is zoomed in region. We're looking at somebody's shoulder. And indeed, here is the clavicle and here is the scapula. We call this a girdle. And as a matter of fact, what kind of girdle is that? It's got a name, pectoral girdle, right? Because you got pectoralis muscles in that region. Pectoral region is right there. So there are two bones, clavicle and scapula. And what we're looking at on this particular slide is the clavicle, right here. And it's kind of an S-shaped bone, and it kind of flares out on either end, kind of, it gets larger as it goes to the ends of the bone. Right. And so here's the superior view, here's the inferior view. I don't think that this is important for you to know other than this is the clavicle, but you have to know which end is which for lab. There's a sternal end and an acromial end. The acromial end articulates with the acromion process on the scapula, and of course the sternal end articulates with the sternum right here. So this right here, this is the manubrium of the sternum, and here's the clavicle. So sometimes we call this joint the manubrioclavicular joint. We can add terms together if we put an O between them. This is the only joint that is attaching your upper appendage to your axial skeleton, just this one little joint right here. So, and the rest are muscles that hold your arm in position. When you get to lab, what might be interesting is to look at the clavicle that I have there in the cat skeleton. And you'll see that the upper appendage in the cat doesn't articulate at all with the axial skeleton. That's sort of interesting to notice. All right, so here is the clavicle. And remember I said it's really important to know your bones, because when you know your bones, you automatically know the names of a lot of vascular anatomy and neuroanatomy and muscle anatomy all at the same time, even though you don't really know it yet. But I'll give you one more example. There is a very important artery that goes right underneath the clavicle, okay, bringing blood to your upper appendage right here. And you could probably take a guess at what the name of that artery is called, if it goes right underneath the clavicle. It's called the subclavian. Subclavian. Subclavian means below the clavicle. And that's a really important artery that we're going to look at in a couple chapters. And the clavicle is fairly easy to break. If it's wedged really tightly between the acromion process and the manubrium right here, if there is lateral pressure applied to it, it has a tendency to fracture. Right? That just happened to a football player over the weekend. Anybody see Tony Romo? He landed on his left shoulder, and another guy landed on top of his right shoulder and smashed his left shoulder into the ground. I'm laughing, but it's not funny. All right. So his left clavicle broke, and you might be wondering, well, gee whiz, how come that usually is not fatal when that happens? Because the clavicle, when it fractures, becomes very sharp and can lacerate muscles and blood vessels and things like that. And there's a big important artery right underneath it. Okay, why are we not usually concerned with that artery? And here is the reason why. Because the clavicle has this S shape to it, when it fractures, this part of the clavicle is designed to break anteriorly. It breaks away from your body. Right, and that spares that artery right underneath it. If it were to break into posterior and inferior, it would lacerate that big, huge artery, and without proper medical care right away, that could be fatal. Right, so the shape of this clavicle has been selected through evolution to protect that artery underneath there. All right, so I see the clavicle, which helps make up the pectoral girdle and the scapula. So we're almost ready to take a look at the scapula. In lab, you're going to have this clavicle. Okay, and you're going to look at it. And it's not going to look like this picture very much. And this is an important point. When you are learning three-dimensional structures, you can use pictures like what you have in your book as a review, but it's not very handy to learn a three-dimensional structure. Because in your book, the acromial end looks just like the sternal end because it flares open like that. But in real life, you'll notice that the acromial end is flat. It's like a knife. But the sternal end looks like the opening of a trumpet or a clarinet. Looks like a musical instrument, the opening right here. So it's a lot thicker and it's almost round, right? And so you can't really get that appreciation from a picture, but you can in lab. And that's why it's so important to come to lab and actually look at these bones, turn them around, right? Put them on your body the way they belong. And then you can use the textbook or any of the drag and drop exercises or other electronic exercises in Blackboard for review, right? So it's important to see the 3D structures in an anatomy lab. All right, so here is clavicle. Now, here is the scapula. Scapula has a lot of pieces to it. There are a lot of important muscles that attach right there. And so let's take a look at this scapula. So here is a cavity or a fossa. And this cavity right here is there to accept the proximal epiphysis of the humerus. Right, so that is a bone in your arm. It attaches to the scapula right here within the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. You could call it either one. Right, so if the humerus attaches here or your arm attaches here, is this the medial or lateral part of the bone? If that's where your arm attaches. That's the lateral part. That's a really nice landmark. Right, so that's why we call this the lateral border. It matches up really nice with the glenoid cavity. Over here, this other straight border, this is what we call the medial border. This runs up and down your spinal cord, which you can feel if you ever give somebody a back rub. Here is a depression. And this is a little bit strange too, because take a look at the skeleton. So what kind of view do we have of the skeleton right here? Anterior or posterior? It's an anterior view. And if we look all the way through the body, right, we all look right through the thoracic cavity, we bump into the scapula, and it's going to look like this. So what view of the scapula is this? Is this an anterior or posterior view? Okay, it's pretty confusing until you see it. So here we have anterior view of the skeleton. Look through the skeleton, and we're going to find this bone just like this. So this actually is the anterior view of the skeleton, but since it's on your back, that's the deep part of the scapula. This is the part that you can't feel, but it nonetheless is still facing anteriorly. It's facing forward. All right. This depression right here is the subscapular fossa. Not too hard to remember. Subscapular. Sub because it is underneath, right? That's the deepest part of the scapula, and it's a depression. And what does a depression do once again? What's the job of a fossa? Sorry. What's a holding something. Yeah. And this fossa is here because it holds a very important muscle. And now that you know this is the subscapular fossa, you also know the name of that muscle, which is really handy. This is called the subscapularis, named after the fossa that it sits in. Right? So subscapular. And that is going to be the one of the anterior muscles on the scapula. Right? So subscapular. Here we have a process that sticks way above the glenoid cavity. We call this the coracoid process. There are important ligaments and muscles that attach to this thing. And then sticking up here behind is the acromion process. And if you palpate your shoulder right now, that's the first bone you're going to bump into, is that acromion process. It sticks way up there. All right, so what else do we have? We got the superior border, medial border, lateral border. Sometimes there's a notch in the scapula, right medial to the coracoid process, and we would call that the suprascapular notch. Supra because it's on what? The superior border. So that is pretty easy to see. All right, I want to take a look at the posterior side of the bone, which is the superficial part. Here we see it. All right, so what is this long edge called? This long straight one here, that is the medial border. right? And then here's the lateral border because it matches up with the glenoid cavity that I just see a little bit of it peeking up, peeking right through here. And then here is the superior border with that suprascapular notch. There are a couple angles on the scapula, like there's a superior angle, inferior angle. That's not hard to remember. All right, but here is a very large raised area on the scapula, right? And it's really rough. What do we call a rough raised area on a bone? That's a process. What's a function of process? Most of the time, muscle attachment. Yeah, you just want to think muscle attachment. It's so easy to remember that, okay? But that's basically what it is. So there are muscles that attach. You can palpate the spine of the scapula because it's sticking straight posterior. You can feel it with your fingertips, and you can actually feel some muscles on either side of it as well. These muscles on either side of it are in their own fossa, their own depression. So here is the infraspinous fossa. What does that mean? Infraspinous, it is below the spine of the scapula, right? And then here is the supraspinous fossa because it's a bowl above the spine of the scapula. And now you know the names of two more muscles. Without even trying, you know the names of these. Right? If this is the infraspinous fossa, then the infraspinatus is going to be in this depression. And take a guess, what muscle is going to be in the supraspinous fossa? The supraspinatus muscle. Right? So that's why knowing bones is really helpful for knowing neuroanatomy, vascular anatomy, right, which I just talked about, muscle anatomy. I haven't talked about neuroanatomy yet, but you already know a lot of neuroanatomy just by knowing these bones. All right, so if you follow this spine of the scapula, and as I move from this border to out over here, which way is this cursor moving? Okay. You got to really think of it. It's easy to mix this up. Okay, so what edge of the scapula do we have the glenoid cavity, medial or lateral? Remember, your arms are attaching right there. So as I move this cursor, it's moving from medial to lateral, right? The lateral edge of the spine is the acromion process, okay? And then in front of it is the coracoid process. And that's pretty much it for the scapula. Is this an exam figure? Does anybody know? Yes, it is. Somebody knows. That's great because you just got to start preparing for that next exam so that all of these things are on the tip of your tongue so that it's actually fun to take a practicum or a lecture exam. Right? Because I would guess there at least one student saw something on a practicum or on the lecture exam and they knew it, but they just couldn't write it down because it just didn't come to their thinking, to their consciousness. And that's what happens if you cram. Right? You know it, but you just can't remember what it's called. So repetition and early preparation will help you with that. And it also reduces a lot of anxiety. Right? And if you're anxious during a test, you're just not going to do as well as when you're not anxious. That's all there's to it. So start early with for the lecture part, it is the study guide. Right? Study guide. Okay. All right, so this is probably one of the more complicated bones in the appendicular skeleton because it has all these fossa, right? I got to mention still a couple more things about it, so we're not quite done. Let's take a look at another view. Here is the glenoid cavity. So what view? We're looking at the scapula. Here's the scapula. What view are we looking at? Medial or lateral? Okay, we're looking from the outside, lateral view toward midline. So here's a nice lateral view of a scapula. And what you bump into first is the glenoid cavity. And that, or you could call it glenoid fossa. So a good question I have right now is, how many fossae does the scapula have? Here's one, glenoid fossa. That's one. How many others do you see? Or how many others do you know? Two more? Okay, name one. Glenoid is one. Supraspinous fossa, right here. That's two. Infraspinous fossa, that's three. Subscapular fossa, four. Indeed, that's all there is to it, right? Four fossae, and you can see them nicely if you have this nice lateral view. All right, so that's almost the last thing that I wanted to show you on the scapula, but I got three more items I want to talk to you about. All right, so this is a depression that the humerus fits into. There is a rough raised area that is right above the glenoid fossa, and there is one right here that's below the glenoid fossa. These things are rough. These are processes. What's the function of these processes above and below the glenoid fossa? You're just going to say muscle attachment, and we're going to learn what those muscles are a little bit later, but indeed, that's what they're there for. These things do have special names. Supraglenoid, because it is, what, superior to the glenoid fossa, and it's called a tubercle. All right, tubercle is just another name for a process, if it has kind of a little small shape to it. And then the one down over here is the infraglenoid tubercle. All right, so supra and infraglenoid tubercle. That's pretty good. I do want you to know those because there's some important muscles. Has anybody heard of biceps brachii? Anybody? Yeah? Okay. Part of that attaches to this tubercle. Anybody hear about the triceps brachii? Maybe not. Okay. It also attaches to a tubercle around the glenoid fossa, right? So that's why these are important because those are really big, powerful muscles that we're going to look at. Let me go back to this previous one of the previous slides. And I am looking at the glenoid cavity. And it kind of has an indentation right here, but it's really a bowl, right? And does this indentation make that bowl look pretty shallow or deep? Does this thing look more like a plate or like a big, deep bowl that you could mix a lot of stuff in? Okay. So here is the indentation right there. To me, it looks like the indentation is not very deep. Okay, it's kind of shallow. So this fossa can't hold very much. And I want to contrast that when we get to the other girdle, which is the pelvic girdle. Right? We're going to look at the fossa that the femur or the thigh fits into. But I want you to see that this is kind of shallow. Right? And we're going to come back to that and maybe it will make a little bit more sense. Right? It's kind of shallow here. And here, this is the edge. It's pretty shallow. Okay, so now we're looking at the bone in what part of your body is this right here? I don't think I'm going to refer to the word slides at all. So you know what I'm going to do? If I can do this. Maybe, I think I need it. Okay, I was going to show it on both projectors. Let me try that. I don't know if I can do that nicely. No, not like that, like this. Okay, I might have to flip through slides because I don't know which one is next. All right, so here is a bone in the upper appendage. And what part of the anatomy are we looking at? Tell me, where is this located? What is this right here? That's the humerus. That's the name of the bone. But what region of the body is that? Is that like your neck, your thorax, your leg? That is your arm. Okay, and that seems really simple, right? That's your arm. But remember, your arm only goes from your shoulder to your elbow. What is that area of your body from your elbow to your wrist called? You can't see it right here, but just the contrast, this is your forearm, right? So that's why this upper appendage, we can't say arm, because arm is just made up of this bone from the shoulder to the elbow. That is your arm. All right, so we're looking at the one bone in the arm, and that is the humerus. Here is a nice smooth surface that's going to be inserted into the glenoid fossa to make your shoulder joint. So this is what we call the head of the humerus. It's not a rough surface. It's covered with hyaline cartilage so that this humerus can glide very nice and easily within the glenoid fossa. Okay, then there's a narrowing right through here. There's a narrowing. And a narrowing on a bone next to the head is what we call the neck of a bone. Maybe when you looked at a rib in lab, you saw that. So here is the neck, but you probably are saying, it doesn't look very narrow right here. It's still really large and massive. It's just a little bit smaller than the head. So we call this the anatomic neck. And that's because there's another part of this proximal epiphysis of this bone that has a tendency to fracture, and that is below these bumps. So this is what we call the surgical neck down over here. Surgical neck, anatomic neck. So when the humerus breaks, it likes to break in this location, and you can see this is narrower than this place up over here. All right, I got two bumps on the bone, and they're rough if you palpate them. So these are processes. What's the function of these two bumps right here? Muscle attachment. Yeah, we're going to learn about those muscles later on. Right now, we're just going to know what these are called. These are tubercles as well. Here is the larger one. The larger one is called the greater tubercle, and the smaller one is called the lesser tubercle. And I could ask you, what side is the greater tubercle on? Is it medial or lateral? Okay. And once you look at that bone and analyze it, here is the head, which is what? Pointing medially into the glenoid fossa. So if we go to the other side of the bone, this greater tubercle has to be lateral. All right, so that's lateral. And that will start to make more sense as we proceed. Right. Here is a depression. And it's a long, narrow depression. And it's for holding something. Usually we don't call that a fossa. We call that a groove, or we could call it a sulcus, right? But a groove or sulcus is nonetheless a fossa. And it goes between the tubercles right here, so that's called the intertubercular groove. Big, important muscle tendon goes right through here. Intertubercular groove. And then if we go down to the diaphysis, remember the shaft of a bone is the diaphysis. There's a rough raised area right here. And so it's a process. And what's that function of this process? Muscle attachment. And the name of it tells you the name of the muscle that attaches right here. The name is deltoid tuberosity. The muscle that attaches right here is the, maybe you haven't learned much in the way of muscles yet, but maybe some of you have. Have you ever heard of the deltoid muscle that's on your shoulder, the top of your shoulder? It goes all the way down here and attaches to the humerus in this location. All right, so if you know this is the deltoid tuberosity, you know a lot about the muscles already around the shoulder. All right, let's go down to the epiphysis down over here. What kind of epiphysis is this down over here? I heard distal. That's great. That's the distal epiphysis. It's got a bunch of pieces to it. These are smooth surfaces. These are condyles, right? But they're really special, so they have special names. The one that kind of looks like a marble is called the capitulum. The one that looks like a spool that you would wind some thread up on, right? This is called the trochlea. And you're going to have to review that a couple times to remember which one is which. It will be really nice to know what side of the bone the capitulum is on. Is it medial or lateral? Okay, you can look at the head, which is medial, opposite side, so we know this is lateral. You could look at the greater tubercle, matches up. Remember, greater tubercle is lateral, so the capitulum is lateral and the trochlea is going to be medial. There are two articulating surfaces or condyles because, guess how many bones are in the forearm? There are two, right? So if there are two condyles right here, that would be a reasonable guess that there are two bones in the forearm, which we're going to get to in just a little bit. There are two depressions on this anterior side of the bone, and this is the radial fossa, and this is going to be called the coronoid fossa. We're going to see how it matches up with those bones in the forearm in just a little bit, and then you'll see that these names are really fortunate. They're named after some other things we have to know, so your knowledge will match up really nice. Here is a process, and it's an epicondyle. Why? Because it is superior to these condyles, right? The capitulum and trochlea. Epi means on top of. And is it medial or lateral? It's medial, right? So the medial epicondyle. That's a process. What's the function of the medial epicondyle? Muscle attachment, right? Because it's a process, muscle attachment. All right, let's take a look at the posterior view of the humerus. So I switched it around, and now I can see the anatomic neck a little bit better in this presentation. Here's the head of the humerus that has that nice hyaline cartilage on it. And so this is the medial side of the bone. This is the lateral. What tubercle is lateral? The greater tubercle, right? So here's the greater tubercle. Now I can see the deltoid tuberosity once again. Oh, look at the surgical neck, right? You can compare the thickness of the bone, anatomic versus surgical neck. deltoid tuberosity. What side of the humerus is the deltoid tuberosity going to be on? Your choices are medial or lateral? Lateral, right. You don't have to know radial groove. I don't think that's in any list for you. All right. And then here's that medial epicondyle once again. Then over here would be the lateral epicondyle. This right here is the posterior view of the trochlea. Should we go back one? Here is the trochlea, which is what? Medial. If we look on that posterior side, right, here is medial. Here is the trochlea. It doesn't wrap around very far at all. And the capitulum would be right here. The posterior view, I don't even see the capitulum. It's mostly only anterior. Above the trochlea is what we call the olecranon fossa. This is a large depression, and that accepts a part of some bone that is in your forearm. Depending on whether your elbow is bent or straight, that bone has to fit into this location. Okay, so remember, trochlea is medial right here. That's probably good, pretty good for now for the humerus. Unless anybody have a question about the humerus? You're going to have to know some bones in the forearm before the humerus makes a lot of good sense. But here's the head of the humerus. Can you tell me where the head of the humerus articulates? What bone does it articulate with? Somebody said glenoid. Yeah, the glenoid fossa, which is part of the scapula, the lateral part of the scapula. Nice. Okay. Let's look at some bones of the forearm. So how many do you have? Yeah, I see two. Come on, cursor. Lost my cursor. Here are two in the forearm. And this is the lateral side. Here is the medial side because we're looking at the right forearm. Remember, this is the forearm. I might have said arm, but this is really forearm. The lateral bone in the forearm is the radius. And the medial bone in the forearm is the ulna. And you'll become really familiar with that, and I hope you will be, because if you know this is the radius, you know the name of a blood vessel that courses right down the radius, right to the base of your, well, I tell you what digit is going to be right here up against the radius? Okay? Somebody told me before I even asked the question. Nice. Your thumb, because in anatomic position, which way do your thumbs face? Laterally, right? So the radius is lateral. That's really, really nice. Okay, so here is the radius, medial. Oh yeah, you can see thumb right here. So that might help you remember that this is the lateral bone. And you might already know that this is called the radius because there's an artery that a lot of people use to count somebody's heart rate with. Right, so right above your thumb, if you use your index finger and place it right there, you can feel bump, 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 a nice pressure pulse coming right through there. Easy to count somebody's heart rate if they have good blood vessels, if it's a normal, healthy person anyway. And does anybody know what kind of pulse that's called? That pulse is called commonly the radial pulse. And before I studied anatomy, I was always wondering, why is that a radial pulse? Well, because it's right by the radius bone. That's why it's called the radial pulse. Okay, it's got another name too, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And so now you know your thumb is lateral, radius is lateral. That's going to be important to know. The proximal epiphysis of the radius, there is a little depression right here that's very smooth, so it's a condyle. And that's what the capitulum fits into. Remember, the capitulum was like a marble or a sphere. It fits right into this depression. And then the ulna, which is the medial bone, there is a hook right here, and I'll have to turn this bone around for you. There is a hook, and that hook fits right up against the other condylar surface of the humerus, and that was the trochlea, right? So remember, capitulum is lateral, the trochlea is medial, and that matches up with the radius and the ulna. So now I probably just want to go back a slide or two to show you. All right, so here is an anterior view, right? So here's the medial epicondyle. The head of the humerus would be way up over here someplace. It's not drawn. And then I see the two condyles, the capitulum and the trochlea, right? Capitulum is lateral, matches up with the radius. Nice spherical structure that fits right in the depression in the head of the radius. And then here is part of the ulna, medial bone, and you see how it fits just perfectly around the trochlea. Okay. And when I look at the elbow, so this is the elbow, anterior view, the elbow is not bent. And I see this process, which is called the coronoid process, it's just sticking out anteriorly, but if I bend my elbow, okay, this big bony prominence right here has to have a place to go. And it fits very nicely into this depression just right above the trochlea. This is called the coronoid fossa. Right? It's called the coronoid fossa because what fits in there? Not any part of the humerus, but the coronoid process of the ulna when you bend your elbow. Over here, this is called the radial fossa. Not labeled on this slide, but it was on one of the previous ones. When you bend your elbow, this edge or lip of the head of the humerus has to have a place to fit in so it doesn't break the humerus, and it fits in right here. Okay, so here is called the radial fossa. Let's flip this around and look on the posterior side. So here is that nice head of the radius. So what side of the elbow is this right here? Medial or lateral? Radius is lateral, so this is the lateral side, and it even says right here, lateral epicondyle. So the head of the radius is going to articulate with that nice smooth surface, which is anterior, and we call that the one that looks like a marble is called the capitulum. Nice. And then here is the olecranon process on the ulna, which acts like a hook that hooks right into this articular surface, this condyle on the humerus. So we said here's capitulum, over here is trochlea. This process right here is called the olecranon process. And that is the point of your elbow that sticks out. All right, so bend your elbow, and you feel that point right there? And now straighten your arm out, keep feeling that olecranon process, and what happens to it? It disappears. Ah, where did it go? Bring it back out. It's still there. All right. Straighten it back out. So where does the olecranon process disappear into? It disappears into the olecranon fossa. Okay. So in lab you get to play with these things and really appreciate what's going on. All right. So if there's a feature on a bone, okay, it could be a process. In this particular case it's a fossa. So here's a fossa. What bone is this depression in? Go ahead, tell me. What bone is this depression in? You got your choices are ulna, radius, humerus. Okay? It is a depression in the humerus, right? And just like when we were naming processes for the skull, we named this fossa here not after the name of the bone that it is on, but the name of the bone that articulates in that particular area. So hence, this thing here, this depression on the humerus is called the olecranon fossa because the olecranon process fits right into it. Okay, and remember, that is medial because the radius is lateral. Right, I'm just looking to see. Oh, here is a really nice view. Let's find out where this is. Here's your thumb. So is this medial or lateral? Lateral. What's bone? What bone is this? Radius, because it's lateral, and then the medial bone is going to be the ulna. And if we disarticulate this ulna, if we take it out and rotate it just a little bit, do you see this hook? Do you see this hook right here? That's what fits into around the trochlea, right? And if it fits around the trochlea, this is a notch, and we're going to call that the trochlear notch. So we put those two things together when you get to lab, and then back down over here, right, the trochlear notch is made up of the coronoid process, right, distally, and the olecranon process proximally, and that just allows the ulna to fit very nicely into the trochlea. One last little detail. The radius and the ulna form a joint right at this location so that you can turn the palms of your hands posteriorly, so that you can turn them anteriorly. The radius has to rotate, right, up against the ulna. So here is the depression in the ulna that the head of the radius rotates in. So it's a depression, it's a fossa more commonly called a notch. So how would we want to name this notch? Not after the name of the bone that it's on, but name it after the bone that articulates right here. What bone articulates right here? The radius, so hence we call that the radial notch. You'll be able to see these things really nicely in lab. All right, so here is that olecranon process. When you bend your elbow, that's the thing that's sticking out. Straighten your elbow out. This is the thing that disappears into what fossa? The olecranon fossa, right on the posterior part of the humerus. All right, well, I know you're going to have to look at this more than one time. And maybe you could listen to the lecture again, but for sure, play around with these bones once you get into lab. All right, let's look at the distal end of these two bones, right? Thumb, so here's lateral, that's got to be radius. Medial bone is ulna. Let's take these out and move over here to this part of the slide. So what bone do I have the cursor hovering over right now? The radius, yeah, it's this lateral one, right? So this is a big, massive part of the radius. It just so happens that's the distal epiphysis. And then over here is the ulna. The distal end of the ulna looks a lot like the head of the radius, and so we call this the head of the ulna as well. Nice, smooth, condylar surface for bones that are in the wrist. Well, in order for you to move your palms posteriorly or anteriorly, we said that the radius has to rotate up against the ulna, but also on this distal end, the ulna has to be able to rotate up against the radius. So here I see another notch, and if you palpate that notch, you're going to see or feel that it's nice and smooth. So it's a condylar surface for a joint. Now, how do we want to name this notch or indentation in the radius? Do we want to name it after the bone that it's on? We do not. We want to name it after the name of the bone that touches right here. And what's the name of the bone that touches right here? The ulna. So here is the ulnar notch, right? So the radial notch is on the ulna, which is proximal. The ulnar notch is on the radius, which is distal. All right, take a look at those things. All right, so that's two bones of the forearm. One thing I didn't mention, there is a ligament that attaches these two bones together. It doesn't prevent motion, but it does stabilize the forearm quite a bit, right? It doesn't prevent you from moving your palms posteriorly or anteriorly. But nonetheless, there is what we call the interosseous membrane. Every time you hear osteo or osseous, you should think of bone, and inter means between. It's the in-between bone membrane. And here it is right here. It just helps stabilize those two bones, but doesn't prevent the motion. All right, so that's going to take us to bones of the wrist. All right, so we're done with the forearm, and we got three more pieces that we want to look at. We have your wrist. There are wrist bones. Then there are bones that make up the hand. And then lastly, there are bones that make up your, what do we call these things that are moving? Those of you that are close can see. Okay, the things that I'm moving right here are what we call digits. These are digits, and the bones that are in the digits are called phalanges. So somebody was really, really close. So what do we got? Wrist, hand, digits, right, or fingers. We don't call them fingers. And that's what I see on this slide right here. All right, so here's the head of the ulna. Here's the radius, and the radius is, once again, what, medial or lateral? Lateral. Ah, look, here's the thumb. Okay? The thumb, we say, is digit number one. And then we just count over. One, two, three, four, and five. So this would be your little finger. All right? So that helps you understand this joint a little bit. These are bones that make up the wrist. And there are eight of them. And I don't want you to know the name of each one. I want you to know the name of one in particular. Right, but what I want you to know is the name of these bones as a group. They are wrist bones, but more scientifically or anatomically correct, we're going to call these carpals. So how many carpals do you have? If you have eight wrist bones, you have eight carpals right here. All right, so here is the radius, this big, massive part of the radius. And what is right, give me the name of the bone that is right below the radius. What bone in your wrist? What bone in your wrist is right below the radius? Okay. Isolunate, which is this one right here, and scaphoid. The one that I want you to be able to identify is the scaphoid. And the scaphoid is like the most medial part bone in of the all the carpals. And this one right here, all right, is noteworthy because when somebody trips and falls and you try to catch yourself with your hands, all right, on the floor, you catch yourself so you don't bang your head on the floor, this big, strong radius bone smashes into the scaphoid, and the scaphoid has a tendency to break because it has a little narrow end to it. So the bone that breaks more frequently than any other carpal in the wrist is the scaphoid, right here, because it's right underneath the radius. Well, that's not the end of the story. What kind of tissue is bone? It's connective tissue, okay? Then I would also ask you, is it living tissue or is it dead? Are there living cells in there? Yeah, what's the name of those cells? Osteocytes, yeah, and those lacunae. So bone is a living tissue. It needs a blood supply to get nutrients and oxygen. When the scaphoid is smashed, it damages the blood vessel that goes to the scaphoid. That blood vessel has a tendency to not grow back. So then what happens to the scaphoid after it's broken? If it doesn't get blood, it dies, right? It dies. And when a bone dies, right, it just, it dissolves away. So a lot of times when somebody breaks a bone in their wrist, it's the scaphoid, and the ultimate endpoint of that is now you're missing, right, some part of one of these carpals, some part of the wrist. So if we change the anatomy like that, if that carpal disappears, what can you tell me about the function? It changes as well, right, and not for the better. So that's why the scaphoid is pretty interesting, right, because it gets smashed when the radius smashes up against it. All right, so how many carpals do we have? We got 8. Now we got bones of the hand, starting with the thumb, number 1. Going over to the little finger, number 5. Your index finger is number 2, and I'll stop there. So these things are not carpals in the hand. These things are called metacarpals. And so you got to know the number and the name. So here's the number 2 metacarpal. Here's the number 5 metacarpal. Those are bones that make up. Take a look at your hand and wrist and fingers. Where do you find these bones? The fleshy part of your hand, palm of your hand, those are metacarpals in there. The carpals make up your wrist, which are in this location. All right, well, let's move distally a little bit more. So here are metacarpals, 1 through 5, starting with the thumb. And then the bones that make up the digits are what we call phalanges. All right, one is called a phalanx, but more than one, the plural is phalanges. And if we look at the index finger, right, so here is a metacarpal. These are phalanges. How many phalanges do you see in your index finger? 1, 2, and 3. Yeah, there are 3. And so these have names. This is the proximal, right, because it's closest to some center location in your body. This one here is what we call middle. And then the most distal one, well, the farthest one away, that's the distal phalanx, right? Here's the distal phalanx. All right, would you want to call this one, where I have the cursor right now, the medial phalanx? Would you want to call that medial? Big difference between medial and middle. Medial means what? Toward midline. It doesn't make sense when all these bones line up superior and inferiorly. There's not one that's more medial or lateral than the other because it's a straight line. So this one right here has got to be called the middle phalanx, right? Middle, not medial. So don't be confused with that. So what phalanx do I have the cursor on right now? How would we name this one? Proximal. But I see one here, and one here. Proximal metacarpal number 2, or number 2 metacarpal, something like that. And everybody would know you're talking exactly about this bone. All right. What about this one right here? How do we name this one, and only this one? That is the number 3 middle phalanx. And what about this one here? Number 4 distal phalanx, right? Well, once you see it, it's really easy, but it's so easy, I think people forget how to name these bones, and there's going to be a bunch of people that miss that on a practicum for some reason. I don't know why that is, right? So I'm giving you a heads up. Okay, make sure you know how to name each one of these bones. It's easy, easy, easy. How many phalanges are in digit number 4? 1, 2, 3. Yeah, proximal, middle, distal. What about digit number 5? Proximal, middle, distal. What about digit number 2? Proximal, middle, distal. What about digit number 1? Proximal and distal, there is no middle. All right, so that might be a way that you could see the thumb compared to any of these other digits. Okay, anybody have a question so far? What's the name of the carpal that you have to know? Scaphoid. Is it medial or lateral? Lateral, because it's right underneath the radius, and the radius is lateral. Okay, and that's the bone that gets smashed really, really bad. All right, so that is the upper appendage. We're ready to move on to the lower appendage, unless somebody's got a question to ask. Anybody have a question? You're pretty good with that. I know you got to study this stuff before it makes a lot of sense. Okay. We looked at the upper appendage, and we looked at the girdle that attaches the upper appendage to the axial skeleton. I'm not showing it here, but does anybody remember what did we call that thing that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton? Pectoral girdle, yeah. And what were the names of the bones that make up the pectoral girdle? Scapula posterior and clavicle anterior. And if you put all those bones together, it kind of encircles the superior part of my thorax, right? And that's why we call it a girdle, because it's surrounding everything. Okay. Well, just like the upper appendage, the lower appendage has a girdle as well, and I see it right here. It's surrounding your whole pelvic region, and so we call this the pelvic girdle. Okay. And the pelvic girdle is made up of two coxal bones, or more commonly, os coxae, or hip bone. So here I see a hip bone, I see a hip bone, and then I see a depression right here. This is analogous to the glenoid fossa, but it's called the acetabulum. It is a fossa nonetheless. This is what the head of the femur fits into, acetabulum. And is this medial or lateral on the pelvic girdle? Lateral, just like the glenoid fossa, right? So the head of the femur is going to be pointing medially to fit right in here. If we look at this, this is just what we call a pelvis bone. The pelvis is made up of two os coxae here and here, and the sacrum. Remember, sacrum is part of the axial skeleton, but it's pretty important in forming the pelvic cavity. Let's take a look at this figure really quickly, and then I want to go back to the previous one. All right, how many colors of bones do you see on this illustration? Three. Nice. Okay. I'm not so sure I do, but I almost do. And that's because, okay, there are three different colors because there are a number of different bones that fuse together during development to make an os coxae up. It's just not one bone. Guess how many bones it takes to make an os coxae during development? Yeah, you see three colors? There are three bones that fuse together. Sometimes you can see these lines of fusion within the acetabulum. On this illustration, it's really nice to see the extent of these bones, but there are three of them. And let's start with the names of these three. The most superior one and the biggest one. This is called the ilium. Ah, right here, ilium. And maybe you notice that ilium right here is in a bold face type because it's referring to this whole bone right here. Not just a piece of the bone, this whole thing right here is the ilium. And this down over here, too bad I don't know the name of this color, but it looks darker. Okay, this whole bone right here is called, in bold, the pubis. And then the third one, in this color right here, all of this one right here is called, what's the bold word? Ischium. Right. So the three bones that make up a hip bone are the ilium, the pubis, and ischium. And it just so happens, I'll mention this a couple times, the ilium is the most superior. The most inferior is the ischium, and the most anterior is the pubis. Okay, anterior is pubis. Now we're ready to go back and look at this. Okay, not nicely color-coded, right? But here is the ilium, the most superior one. Here is the most anterior. Go ahead, take a guess. that is the pubis, and the most inferior is the ischium. Oh, look, I didn't see this, right? That's really nicely labeled. Ilium, pubis, and ischium joined together to form an ascaxe, right? And you got two of them. Okay, and then this is the most anterior part. Here is a joint between the two pubic bones called the pubic symphysis. That's a nice fibrocartilage joint. It's really secure, right? And it stabilizes the pelvic cavity or the pelvis nicely. This thing right here dissolves away during parturition. What's parturition? Parturition. What does that mean? It might seem like a very unnatural process that I'm talking about, but it is a very natural thing. That is what? Giving birth to somebody. Right? So before somebody gives birth, this pubic arch dissolves away to a large degree and it allows for separation of the pubic bones, and that enlarges the birth canal. Right? So that's really handy. None of us would be born if that pubic symphysis didn't expand a little bit. And then after somebody gives birth, then what happens to the pubic bones? They come back together again. Mostly, but not exactly. Okay? Okay. Also, these joints between the sacrum and the ilium, they loosen up as well for parturition. Right? And then they go back mostly the way they were. All right, what other features do I want to look? Here is a hole in the ascaxe. This is called the obturator foramen. Is it labeled on the slide? Not labeled on the slide. I'll show you in a little bit. All right, but what are some things that are labeled? Acetabulum, that depression, and make sure you know the acetabulum is medial or is it lateral? It is lateral. That's going to be a really important landmark. Here is the ilium. Here is a long raised area on a bone, and it's really rough. Right? It's a process. What's the function of a process? Muscle attachment. Big, powerful muscles attach right here, right? Because this has got to hold up your whole body weight. And so it's called the iliac crest. Here is a point right at the anterior part of that iliac crest. There's a point that's sticking out. That's a process as well. And so we want to call this one the anterior superior iliac spine because it's pointing out. Right? And you know this is anterior. And if it says superior right here, guess what that kind of infers? If this is the superior one, there's got to be an inferior one. And if we look down over here, here's the inferior one, the inferior spine on the ilium. And it's anterior as well, so we call this the anterior inferior iliac spine, right here and right here. We're going to notice that the posterior side has two as well. One is superior, one is inferior. Here is a depression in the ilium called the iliac fossa. And this is holding something, not so many muscles, but pelvic organs. So it's a depression. And what else do I see over here? That's probably pretty good. Sacrum we look at in lab. Okay, that's good. Let's look at these bones. Let's take them apart. I don't see a sacrum anymore. Pubic bone is which one? If you're going to describe a pubic bone, where do we find it? Anterior, that's right. So here is the anterior. Remember on the ilium, it had some spines. Here's the anterior superior iliac spine. Here's the anterior inferior, right? And it's going to line up really nice with the pubic bone so that you can find it. And so that means this is the posterior part of that hip bone or ascaxe. So here's the posterior superior iliac spine. Here's the posterior inferior iliac spine. All right, then right below that, look at this big notch. This is going to be a really nice landmark so that you know this is the posterior side of the bone. This is called the greater sciatic notch. All right, so if there's a greater sciatic notch, you could make a good guess that there is a lesser sciatic notch. If there was just one, then it wouldn't be greater or lesser, it would just be the sciatic notch. But there are two. So here's the greater sciatic notch. And does this one look smaller right here? Does that look smaller to you compared to the greater one above it? Yeah. So this is the lesser sciatic notch. There is something important between the greater and lesser sciatic notch. This is another process that sticks way out, and it's a spine. But this spine is not on the ilium. This spine is on what bone? The ischium. So this is called the ischial spine, and there's only one. So we don't have to say superior or anterior or whatever, right? There's only one. But you should probably know this is posterior because here's the pubic bone, which is anterior. Okay. So that ischial spine is going to be a nice landmark so you can find the greater and lesser sciatic notches. Here's that obturator foramen once again. And here's that acetabulum, the depression. In lab, you're just going to have to point this out to yourself, make sure it's true. The acetabulum is a lot deeper compared to the glenoid fossa. Right? It's a lot deeper, so the head of the femur inserts very deeply into this hip bone, unlike the head of the humerus into the scapula. So here is something that kind of looks like a fan or a wing right here. Right? A name for that is called an ala. So this is the ala of the ilium. On the opposite side, remember there was a depression called the iliac fossa. Well, the iliac fossa is part of that ala that is sticking up, right, superiorly. And you know what? I think that's about it for this particular view that you have to know. All right. Now, what about this view right here? Medial or lateral? How would you know? Medial. I like medial. How would you know? Cannot see acetabulum. Right? I don't see an acetabulum there, but there is something I do see, and that is that iliac fossa for holding pelvic organs, right? So that's facing medially. So again, I see the ilium. Here's the major part of the ilium. It's not the ala. This is what we call the body. Right? Nice pubic bone, little tubercle right here. Ah, here is the body of the pubic bone. Here is some bone that's at a 90 degree angle to the body of the pubic bone. What do we call a bone that projects at 90 degrees from the body of something? A ramus, right? So here's the superior ramus of the pubic bone, and if this is a superior, what could you guess? There's got to be a inferior one as well. And then here's the inferior ramus of the pubic bone, superior. And then here's what forms the pubic symphysis, right between the two. So this is the most medial part of the bone. Obturator foramen. I've been telling you that's what it is. Here it is, labeled nicely. I wasn't making that up. All right, so remember, pubis is anterior. So here's the anterior superior iliac spine, anterior inferior. If we look over here, posterior superior, posterior inferior. They're on the iliac or on the ilium, and they're spines, so they're called iliac spines. And then down over here, here's another spine. Which one do we want to call this one between the greater and lesser sciatic notches? Ischial, right? Ischial, a lot different than the iliac spines. I think that's probably pretty good for now. All right, so that makes up a girdle. What girdle does that oscoxae make up? Yeah, completely surrounds your pelvic cavity. All right. And just like in the upper appendage, the lower appendage, the first part of the lower appendage has one bone. It's not the humerus, it is the femur. It's going to look kind of similar. Here is the head, nice smooth condylar surface that fits into, what does this head of the femur fit into very nicely? Acetabulum, nice. And it fits very deeply into the acetabulum. Here is a narrowing, and we call that the neck, and you can see it's a lot narrower than the neck on the humerus, so actually when the femur breaks, it can break right here frequently. So there is no surgical neck on the femur like there is on the humerus. There are a couple bumps, just like on the humerus, but we don't call these tubercles on the femur. These things right here are called trochanters. Trochanters are processes. So what's the function of these trochanters if they're a process? Muscle attachment, rough raised area in a bone, and they're big, huge processes, which means what can you tell me about the muscles? Little dinky muscles or big, powerful muscles? Big, powerful, strong muscles, right? And it makes that bone really nice and strong. Okay. And, okay. We go to what, 1205? Okay, a couple more minutes. I'll tell you a fun story. Here's a little dimple in the head of the femur. It's a little depression. It's called fovea capitis. Capitis means head. Fovea means a depression. There is a ligament that attaches there that goes over to the acetabulum and attaches to the to the ascoxate, and that helps stabilize, right, that joint. Inside of that ligament, it's called, you don't have to know the name of that ligament right now, Mark, but there's a blood vessel that goes through there. Okay, and that blood vessel brings blood to the head of the femur. Why is that important for the head of the femur to get blood through that artery? What can you tell me about a bone? Is it living or not living tissue? Living tissue, right. It needs that oxygen, the nutrients coming from that artery. And so if that artery is damaged, guess what happens to the head of the femur? It dies, dissolves away. Right, and so instead of having a nice smooth surface right here, you got this jagged edge, right, grinding up against the acetabulum. Okay, there was a football player, maybe one of the most impressive athletes of all time. He was a football player and a baseball player during the same season. Did somebody say Bo Jackson? Did I hear Bo Jackson? I think I did. Okay, Bo Jackson played football, got tackled one time on the side. Another big, powerful guy smashed into him, and it damaged that ligament and destroyed the blood vessel going to, attaching to the fovea capitis, so the head of the femur started to dissolve away. Well, when the head of the femur dissolves away, what can we do for people? They push it off as long as they can, but once they get it, they're usually really thankful. You can get an artificial hip placed, a prosthetic hip. So Bo Jackson had to do that. And he was such a phenomenal athlete, even with an artificial hip, he went back and played professional baseball. Is that incredible? Even with an artificial hip joint, just like that. He never went back to play football, which is a good thing. Okay, but he was tremendous. All right, so that tells you a little bit about how important blood supply is to bone. It's a living tissue, and how well people can do with prosthetic joints. That's pretty amazing. Okay, so sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Make sure you sign it, and I got to finish appendicular skeleton up next time. But it's going to be pretty fast because it's very similar to your upper appendage.